It is the Brett Winterbull Show, News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT. No place I'd rather be than with you right here in the beautiful Queen City. Our phone number is 704-570-1110. No doubt you've been paying a little bit of attention to what we've watched play out here in the last 5 or 6 hours, and that, of course, is the big showdown in Geneva. You know, they were on the Lake Geneva shore, and nobody shot a flare gun. That's important to know that. There was no smoke on the water. A lot of smoke, though, coming out, I think, from both sides as Putin and President Biden got together. Let me say this. I'm an honest broker, so I'm going to say this right out of the box. I don't think Biden lost, but I do think Putin kind of won. And I've got a couple of clips that I think will demonstrate that. I don't know what this was really supposed to be. It felt like all the pomp and circumstance that we all remember well from the 1980s, even into the early 1990s, as American presidents at the time, Ronald Reagan or George H.W. Bush or Bill Clinton got together with their Russian counterparts at the waning moments of the Soviet Union, the collapsing moments of the Soviet Union, and then the rising moments of the Russian Federation. I'm not really 100% sure what this was supposed to be, because going into all of this, if we can reset the conversation back to Monday and even into the weekend, the big topic for Joe Biden was climate change. He was supposed to go in there and talk climate change. Things transitioned as he got to the NATO summit and then got to this meeting with Vladimir Putin there in a villa in Geneva. And it appeared that there were a number of topics kind of kicked around, but no real resolution coming from this. I will say this, and I declared it earlier in the day, about 7 o'clock this morning when the two of them arrived at this villa in Geneva. You saw President Biden on the right hand side of the portico. You saw President Putin, or whatever he calls himself, on the left hand side of the portico. And there was Biden with a big, huge grin, big old white teethy grin looking there. You had you had Vladimir Putin looking, kind of intense the way he generally is. But there he was standing. And it's interesting to see them side by side, because you think of Vladimir Putin as like Ivan Drago from that Rocky movie. And he's really not. He's like 5'6", 5'7". He's kind of fun size. Joe Biden's towering well over him, and Joe Biden's all grinning and smiling, and Putin is kind of nonplussed. And I declared the weigh-in a loss for Joe Biden, because he just didn't look like he was bringing his A game. But I guess he held his own. But I will tell you this: in the battle of the dueling press conferences, Putin owned it. Putin owned it in a huge way. And we've got an ambassador coming on at 4:20 who's going to help us understand this. One of the topics was the START talks, and that's the new iteration of the nuclear weapons negotiation that's taking place sort of on the side channel here. But Ambassador Bellingsea is going to join us at 4:20 to talk about his assessment of what we saw here. But as they moved into this villa, you saw President Biden. He had a stack of cards, index cards, that were clearly either prompts or topics that he wanted to raise, or they were topics that the prime minister of our government, the guy who really does run the actual government himself, Ronnie Klain, had laid out a series of topics for him to bring up with Vladimir Putin. And of course, Joe Biden was kind of looking at those cards. A reporter asked if he trusted Putin. The president, President Biden, nodded that he did trust Putin. And then the White House, Jen Psaki, had to come running out, panicky, saying, no, he wasn't answering that question. He was just nodding in the general direction of the exact reporter that asked that question at that exact moment, as if to indicate that he recognized the reporter, which is a total crock of you know what. So you had next to Joe Biden, Tony Blinken, the crooner in chief, was there, and he was ready to talk about how if you had a beautiful body, would you hold it against him? You know, whatever, covering the Bellamy brothers. And so there's Lavrov, who's a real killer next to Putin. And they had a meeting for about two and a half hours. Then they brought in some of the hangers-ons, including, interestingly enough, Victoria Nuland, who I would argue is the midwife and maybe the actual mother of the lie that Donald Trump got elected with Russian help. She pushed that dossier harder than almost anybody in government. and has never been held to account for that. She's a lifelong deep state operative. You'll see her on television tonight. She was the lone woman in the meeting. She was wearing a purple pantsuit. She's got darkish hair. And she is not a person that you would want to be friends with, because she will concoct whatever conspiracies and schemes she can to weaken political opponents. And in that case, it was the sitting president of the United States, Donald John Trump. So at the conclusion of this meeting that took place there in Geneva, you had the two parties come out. The first party to come out was Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin handled this press conference masterfully, and it's really the only way to put it. He handled it masterfully. I'm not a fan of Putin per se, but I'm going to acknowledge when I think people perform well under these circumstances, and I'm going to point out when I don't think people perform well under these circumstances. Vladimir Putin understood how to speak right to the heart of the American people. He talked about dissidents, and he talked about dissidents in his own country. Here's what he said about Black Lives Matter and violence that broke out here a year ago, and why he doesn't want to see that kind of stuff in his country. Cut 25.
America quite recently had to deal with terrible events after the murder of, or the killing of the African-American, and Black Lives Matter ensued. I don't want to make any judgment about that, but what we saw, mass violations of the law and so on and so forth, we sympathize with the Americans, but we do not wish that this kind of thing should happen on our territory, and we will do our utmost to prevent it.
You see what he did there? He's damning us with faint praise. He says, listen, I saw what happened with Black Lives Matter and the Black Lives Matter riots. I saw what was going on with Antifa and the riots in the cities and the burnings and the lootings and all that kind of stuff. And we don't want that coming into Russia. We don't want to see that kind of lawlessness happening in Russia. He connected with a substantial population of the American people talking about that, because the overwhelming majority of Americans, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat, you don't want to see your cities burning. But he acknowledged that they did. And make no mistake, Vladimir Putin is well aware that one of Joe Biden's first orders of business at the outset of that rioting was to go into a church and take a knee. Vladimir Putin took no knees. Now, I don't think Vladimir Putin's a good guy. I think he's a bad guy. I think he's a terrible person. But he spoke directly to the American people without the benefit of having Joe Biden there to defend the honor of the United States. That was a big mistake. There's another big mistake coming up, and I'll share that with you directly. News Talk 1110-993 WBT. We're taking your phone calls, 704-570-1110. Here's the question for you. I know that we made out Putin to be this huge uber villain going into this gathering with President Biden and his entourage. But the question is, does Putin still rate? Is he still like, you know, Mr. Bad Guy, or is he just sort of a side villain? What do I mean by that? Well, I would say, like, if we were going in the panoply of villains in a superhero comic, like, I would say Xi Jinping is the Joker. Okay, I'd say Xi Jinping is the Joker. I would say Vladimir Putin is more akin to, I guess, he's the Penguin. He's the Penguin. You never really knew what the Penguin could do. He was just kind of like evil guy, right? The Joker was super evil. The Penguin was just kind of evil. And then, like, I don't know, the Iranians would be the Riddler or something, you know. Riddle me this, you know. And so I don't look at Vladimir Putin the way I did even a decade ago or 15 years ago. I just view Vladimir Putin as kind of an aging guy who doesn't have the juice, but he understands very well how to manipulate people. Let me show you what I'm talking about. He spoke to a very specific topic, and the fact that President Biden was not side by side with him at this press conference, I think, was a huge mistake for the Biden team. I think they were really afraid that he was going to get upstaged by Putin. Putin was dynamic, and I'm not praising Putin. I'm just assessing Putin. He was dynamic. He was answering questions. He was bobbing. He was weaving. He was ignoring questions he didn't want to answer. And the topic of Black Lives Matter, as you heard in that first segment, came up and he addressed it and said, listen, the reason why we crack down on people that are looking to make trouble in Russia is we don't want to have like a Black Lives Matter kind of a situation with cities burning and looting and riots and things like that happening in our country. But then he spoke to a very specific instance of this whole concern. And that very specific instance was the January 6th riot, the January 6th, quote, insurrection. And we've got a story on that coming up here shortly. But let me let you hear what it is that Putin says about the insurrection. And listen to his words. Listen to his words. This is Putin, cut number 24.
People entered with some political demands at the Congress of the U.S. 400 people are now persecuted under criminal persecution. So they face a prison term of up to 20 or 25 years. They are called domestic terrorists. And they are accused of a number of other crimes. 70 people were detained right away after those events, and 30 of them are still detained, apprehended, and no one knows why, for what reason, because no official authorities in the States informed us about any of that. And one of the participants, few people died there. One of the participants was shot by a policeman, by a police officer there, and she didn't threaten this police officer with a weapon. The same things happen in a lot of countries, things that we have here. And I would like to emphasize one more time, we sympathize with what is happening in the United States, but we do not want to see the same things happening here.
That's twice he makes that point. That's twice he makes that point in about a 4-minute span. He's talking to the American people. And he is rebutting directly what Merrick Garland said yesterday when he declared white supremacy is the greatest threat facing the United States and we need domestic terrorism laws. Putin says these guys are charged with domestic terrorism, but we don't even know what that means. Like, what does that mean? And then you want to tell us that we can't lock up Navalny and that we can't get tough on the Chechens and we can't do all these sorts of things. Putin understands the United States better, I think, than Joe Biden does, frankly. I mean, to be totally honest with you. And so he's speaking to a constituency in the United States that is sick and tired of what we've seen for going on 13, 14 months, lawlessness in our cities. Putin's like, listen, you got to get control of your cities. I don't want to interfere with what's going on in your country, but it's kind of a disaster right now. Meanwhile, you got Biden yesterday laughing. I don't know what that was, but this idea that he says specifically, we don't want BLM violence on our streets, number one. Number two, hey, you guys, you had 400 people get arrested because they were protesting the outcome of the election. That's how Putin spins it. See, he's a cagey guy. He's a KGB guy. No, but he's a cagey guy. He understands that this is what you got to do. So what is Biden talking about? He's talking about cyber warfare, cyber issues, climate issues, all that sort of stuff. But he doesn't get any deliverables out of this. There's no deliverables. This was a photo op. And I think what Putin decided was, well, if Joe Biden wants to use me for a photo op and wants to play tough guy, then I'm going to go out first. I'm going to set the narrative. We're going to proceed. When Biden came out, this is the first thing Joe Biden said. This is cut number 27. This is the very first thing Joe Biden said when he came out to talk to the American press.
I'll take your questions. And as usual, folks, they gave me a list of the people I'm going to call on. So, Jonathan, Associated Press.
And listen to a question.
Thank you, sir. U.S. intelligence has said that Russia tried to interfere in the last two presidential elections and that Russia groups are behind hacks like.
I mean, so he goes right to the Russia interference thing. Jonathan Lemire is the most predictable, weak-kneed, poor excuse for a reporter. And he's with the Associated Press. And he asks this question at every press conference of Joe Biden. What do you think about Russia trying to interfere in the election? He should have said to Joe Biden, Vladimir Putin just came out here and said that the January 6th insurrection is an excuse for you to lock up political prisoners that you will not let out of solitary confinement. Do you have anything to say about that? He knows Biden can't answer that question, so he doesn't ask it. He goes to the old hits. Like an aging crooner, Joe Biden plays the hits from 1973. Raindrops keep falling on my head. News Talk 1110. It is the Brent Winterbull Show, News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT. So let's pivot off of that last little bit of discussion that we heard from Putin, and also by extension from of course the President of the United States, Joe Biden, because Joe Biden was pressing on Navalny and on these political prisoners that are being held against their will in Russia and in some cases maybe getting tortured. Look, I've been a vocal supporter of human rights the entirety of my life. I know many in this audience have as well. We remember clearly the positions that Reagan staked out when it came to defending people who were being held against their will in all of these communist hellholes. And it continues to go on to this very day in Russia as well. But one of the things that we've got to come to grips with is this idea that we are watching a transformation of law enforcement in this country. We are not seeing law enforcement being deployed at the border against cartels. We are not seeing law enforcement grabbing cartel veteranos and locking them up and deporting them. We're not seeing any of that. We're not seeing American cities patrolled by police officers in a way that you would come to expect that to be the case. You're seeing a record number of law enforcement officers in places like Atlanta, New York City, Chicago, Seattle, Los Angeles, looking to get out of these cities because they're not allowed to police any longer based on dictums and directives by politicians. What became clear to me yesterday in watching the speech by Merrick Garland about the redefinition of domestic terrorism and the domestic terrorism threats in our country was there is a move afoot that will likely continue under the first term of Joe Biden into what would be a term of Kamala Harris or a second term of Joe Biden or what have you, to convert the Department of Justice and our intelligence community to an interior ministry, which is something profoundly un-American. I was made very uncomfortable when I first heard of this new agency called the Department of Homeland Security and the notion that we were going to secure the homeland. It felt very European to me, and interior ministries run in that exact same vein where they can deploy intelligence agencies against Americans. We saw that with Joe Biden and Barack Obama and Susan Rice and the Obama administration spying on American citizens working on the Trump campaign. We have seen wiretapping against American citizens. We have seen surveillance against American citizens. We have seen Adam Schiff wiretap and get the phone records of fellow congressmen like Devin Nunes, who will be on this program, by the way, coming up on Friday at 5:30. This is a transformation that's taking place in the Department of Justice into the Interior Ministry of the United States. The masks were sort of a nice little kind of attempted sort of a little bit of control over us to see what we'll put up with. Go on an airplane these days, the Interior Ministry will not let you stay on that airplane if you take your mask off. So I'm reading this piece over in Revolver News, and the truth of the matter is, I sent you a clip, TJ. The story out of Revolver News is unbelievable. Tucker Carlson was discussing it last night. Unindicted co-conspirators in the January 6th cases are raising disturbing questions about federal foreknowledge of the riots. And the scene setter is this Q&A that takes place between Christopher Wray, who's the head of the FBI, and Amy Klobuchar. And Amy Klobuchar asks him directly, you know, did you have any foreknowledge? Did you have any infiltration of these groups that were coming into Washington, D.C. to find out what it was that they were planning or anything like that? Do you remember the story right after the riot itself on January the 6th? This is me talking, not Klobuchar. But do you remember we did the story about Bank of America giving up to the Department of Justice telephone records to see who it was that was in Washington, D.C., where they were spending money, where they were staying, as part of their massive surveillance of Washington, D.C. And it didn't make sense to me at the time, but it does after reading this. It makes sense to me now, because how would you know where to look for the people that would be involved in insurrecting? You'd need to have a controlled character there. You need to have a plant. You need to have a witness. You'd need to have an informant. You'd need to have somebody who was actively part of the planning to figure out who was with that person. Otherwise, you're just taking a blind shot at whoever you could take a blind shot at. So do you have that clip, TJ? Is that one ready to go? Okay. This is Amy Klobuchar questioning Christopher Wray about infiltrating these, quote, patriot groups, going into January the 6th go.
And they show up, we now know, in this complaint with encrypted two-way Chinese radios and military gear that you must, there must be moments where you think, if we would have known, if we could have infiltrated this group or found out what they were doing. And that, do you have those moments?
Absolutely. I will tell you, Senator, and this is something I feel passionately about, that anytime there's an attack, our standard at the FBI is we aim to bat 1,000, right? And we aim to thwart every attack that's out there. So anytime there's an attack, especially one that's this horrific, that strikes right at the heart of our system of government, right at the time transfer of power is being discussed, you can be darn tootin' that we are focused very, very hard on how can we get better sources, better information, better analysis, so that we can make sure that something like what happened on January 6th never happens again.
So the narrative is the intelligence community failed once again, just like September the 11th, right? Except that it didn't. It didn't. In fact, the federal government, according to the reporting over at Revolver.News, indicates that the feds did have undercover agents or confidential informants embedded in so-called militia groups for conspiring to obstruct the Senate certification of 1-6. The implications would be nothing short of seismic if that was the case. Well, especially if agents or informants enjoyed extremely senior level positions in the groups. In other words, what if these aren't just informants? Like, hey, I don't like this conversation that's going on with these guys. It sounds like they're going to go and storm the Capitol. What if instead the person who's saying it is actually the person who's organizing it, and they're federal agents, and they're in the organization at the top end, going, hey, guys, let's go storm the Capitol. I got an idea. Let's go storm the Capitol. Because there's like 16 unindicted co-conspirators that are not named in these indictments as part of the 1-6, as part of the 1-6 riot. One of the key consensus points among the FBI and the DOJ is the idea that while January 6th is primarily the fault of Trump-supporting QAnon-infused domestic terrorists, it is secondarily the fault of so-called intelligence failures, which means you need more surveillance, right? That's what happened after 9/11. Klobuchar's own question reinforces the intelligence failure narrative. Five-month bipartisan Senate investigation recently arrived at the exact same conclusion. It was an intelligence failure, which means the fix is more intelligence gathering against the United States citizenry. Turns out the federal government, the FBI, Army Counterintelligence, or a similar agency, had undercover agents or confidential informants embedded in many of the groups involved on January the 6th, the federal intelligence agencies failing to warn of a potential for violence looks less like an innocent mistake and more like something more sinister. They sat back to make sure it would happen. Still more disturbingly, possibility arising from a careful study of unindicted co-conspirators listed throughout the charging documents of individuals relating to January the 6th. At Revolver News, they noticed a pattern from the months-long investigation, and in particular, the study of the charging documents related to those indicted. In many cases, the unindicted co-conspirators appear to be much more aggressive and egregious participants in the very so-called conspiracy, serving as the basis for charging those who were indicted. And we could dive into this when we come back, but it's really shocking to look at this. I mean, yes, you've got your Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, 3%ers, what have you, but you've also got people who were egging them on, who were pushing for the breach of the Capitol. Remember when you used to laugh when they'd say, 9/11's an inside job? I used to laugh. It's entirely possible that the January 6th insurrection was an inside job perpetrated in some measure by infiltrators from law enforcement. I'm not letting the people who went in and rioted off the hook. You don't have a right to go in and riot in the Capitol. But I do think it's interesting. We ought to know who these people are. I mean, we know the name. We just don't say it. But we know the name of the person that murdered Ashley Babbitt for standing in a doorway. Even Vladimir Putin noted that was the case. But we just won't talk about the fact that that guy who's accused of shooting her was also a guy who, like an idiot, left a loaded weapon sitting on a bathroom sink in the Capitol, unattended, once upon a time. Continuing the conversation, Brett Winterbull, News Talk 1110-993 WBT. This is from June 14th, so just 2 days ago, Revolver.News. And it is the reporting on unindicted co-conspirators in January 6th case raises disturbing questions about federal foreknowledge of the actual insurrection that took place. And so essentially what they're doing is they're saying, okay, you got two different groups of people. You got these people that just kind of like showed up to be a part of the thing, whatever the thing was. They went to the rally, and then they went onto the Capitol grounds, and they walked through open doors, and they maybe removed, you know, barricades. And so what Revolver News says is, okay, those are like harmless tourist types, okay? But if you look at the other group of people that they're really interested in, the unindicted co-conspirators who belong to any of the big three militia groups, Oath Keepers, Proud Boys, Three Percenters. Indeed, it is these militia groups whose behavior, statements, and planning led up to and during January the 6th most closely align with the violent insurrectionist caricature that we hear about in the media, in which the government claims to be going after aggressive prosecutions. Turns out, according to this reporting out of Revolver.News, that an extraordinary percentage of the members in the groups involved in the planning and executing of the Capitol siege were federal informants or undercover operatives. The implications would be nothing short of staggering if that holds water. This would be far worse than the already bad situation of the government knowing about the possibility of violence and doing nothing. Instead, this would imply that elements of the federal government were active instigators in the most egregious and spectacular aspects of 1-6, amounting to a monumental entrapment scheme used as a pretext to imprison otherwise harmless protesters at the Capitol and to frame the entire MAGA movement as potential domestic terrorists. So this article goes on and on. It's many pages long. It's very interesting. As I said, it's posted up over at the front page of Revolver.News. One of the things they point to as an example of this sort of an operation, though, was that famous Michigan plot to kidnap and to put on trial Gretch Whitmer. You had 14 individuals who allegedly plotted the kidnapping and overthrow of the state government of Michigan. At least five were undercover agents and federal informants. That's five out of 14. That we're working together with the federal government. Is that entrapment? I don't know. That's going to have to get fought out in court. But it is curious and interesting. And it does speak to a certain reality of the country in which we were living back in 2020. And that is, the country was effectively shut down. What a shutdown country does is creates desperation in many corners, right? But what else a shutdown country does is it makes it a lot easier to surveil people. Because you're supposed to be home, theoretically speaking. So this is a very interesting story and one that we will continue to look at more closely. Peter is up first. Peter, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I was wondering why you didn't mention the Freedom Act.
Yes.
Replace the Patriot Act.
Yes.
Because that is point on to everything that you're talking about. Granted, I caught the conversation probably midway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I didn't talk about the Freedom Act. I was talking about the current set of circumstances involving January 6th. But the Freedom Act is an important act to try to right the wrong that you got with the Patriot Act, which is basically permanent domestic surveillance of American citizens. And it's important that we get our civil liberties back and we have them preserved. I go back to my central contention at the bottom of this hour, which was, you have a transformation taking place between the intelligence agencies of this country and the Department of Justice, and what the creation of an interior ministry designed to manage the affairs of American citizens here in the country. So that's essentially what you have. I appreciate the call. And that's a big challenge, because my default position is always freedom. I don't care if you want to be a Jacobin, if you want to be an anarchist, if you want to be a nihilist, just don't break stuff and beat people up and shoot people. Like, you can have whatever kooky ideology. Yes, it was only a matter of weeks ago that I called for the banning of Marxism as a terribly dangerous ideology. I put it on par with pedophilia and cannibalism, and I said that as much, okay? I think Marxism is that deadly and lethal of an ideology. But you can walk around believing in Marxism all you want. I just don't want to see you going out and burning down police stations in the name of Marxism. I don't want to see you taking over the education system in the name of Marxism, in the same way that I don't want to see you going out and taking over our schools in the name of Wahhabism, or in the name of radical Islamic terror, or ISIS, or Al-Qaedism. You know, there's a reality that we're living in here. We could have a ton of different ideas, and they're all fascinating, and they can be debated. The problem is, I'm willing to bet 45-50% of the population is not capable of engaging in a standard traditional political debate. Their default position is either cancellation or violence. And that's what happens when you go lowest common denominator when it comes to big ideas. That's what happens. Politics is not for the timid, but politics is also not for the dumb. Politics is a very serious endeavor. And if your default position is to run up and punch a cop or to go steal somebody's flag or to punch somebody because you don't agree with their message, then you have no business being in politics, because that is not a political decision. That is an act of violence, and acts of violence predicated upon a political disagreement, and exclusively a political disagreement, are indicative of a person who's not smart enough to understand the difference between an argument and a fight. And far too many people in this country have no idea how to have an argument, how to create an argument, how to defend an argument, and how to defeat an argument. Their answer is a milkshake filled with cement hitting the head of Andy No, shooting somebody in the street because you disagree with them, bombing a building. Those are people far, far too dangerous and too lacking in intellect to be a part of the broader political debate. And that is the danger in a free society. Hour number two of the Brett Winterbull Show, News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT. Question from the last hour. I'll throw it into this one. Is Vladimir Putin the supervillain that you always thought he was? A serious question. I mean, how much of a villain is he? I submitted that he's sort of like the Penguin. He's not as dangerous as the Joker or the Riddler, to use a little Batman analogy, but does he still scare you? Is he still a boogeyman? Feels like he's an aging quarterback just hoping to get through one more season. 704-570-1110, 704-570-1110 is the phone number to be a part of the conversation. Let me hit you with this, though. We've got a great guest, by the way, coming up at 420. He's an ambassador, former ambassador, who worked on the START treaty. Get his thoughts on a number of these different issues that are in front of us. But Ted Cruz, let's take it down to the border. You heard that report from Bill Malugin just a few moments ago in Anna's update. Here is Ted Cruz doing an amazing soliloquy on the floor of the Senate, breaking down the border crisis, brought to you by Biden-Harris.
The crisis that has unfolded is the direct result of political decisions made by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Number one, the first week in office, President Biden immediately halted construction of the border wall. Number two, that same week, President Biden reinstated the failed catch and release policy. And number three, most inexplicably, the Biden administration ended the Remain in Mexico international agreement, an historic agreement negotiated by President Trump with the government of Mexico, whereby the government of Mexico agreed that those who crossed illegally into Mexico would remain in Mexico while their asylum proceedings were pending in the United States. That agreement was a tremendous success. It produced last year the lowest rate of illegal immigration in 45 years. Let me repeat that. Just 6 months ago, our country had achieved the lowest rate of illegal immigration in 45 years. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris come into office. They rip to pieces the international agreement that produced that success. And today we have the highest rate of illegal immigration in 20 years.
It's a huge, huge chart that he's laying out, charting this course. And the reality is Joe Biden has been present for the entirety of the border failure, from even back in 1986 with the awful Simpson-Mazzoli bill that passed, that granted amnesty to millions of people in this country illegally, and never got any enforcement all the way right up to the present day, in which he is the man who pulled that plug on that deal with Mexico, the Remain in Mexico directive. And for those people who don't understand why that's a big deal, is the idea that you were going to travel all this way, come up to the American border, then get put back in Mexico was highly unpalatable to people who might be making the journey from Ecuador or from Venezuela or from Romania. They sat back and they said, wait a minute, so we're just going to get stuck in Mexico? We don't want to go to Mexico. Even people in Mexico don't want to go to Mexico. I mean, my gosh, we got to be able to get to the United States to get the real cheesecake. That was not going to be a palatable option. And what was brilliant about that, that the folks over on MSNBC don't understand, is that it was also beneficial to the people of Mexico, because the people of Mexico didn't have to worry about huge migrant flows. If people were going to end up staying in Mexico, they were just going to stay home anyways. So it actually benefited Mexico as well. You had a couple of hundred or a few thousand there in Mexico, remaining in Mexico, waiting to be heard as part of their process. But it stopped that flow into the North American countries, right? You had a choke point there at the Guatemala border with Mexico. It's a very narrow border. And you ensured that you could enforce that part of the border. We ensured that we could enforce our part of the border. And it was a policy that worked. Now, President Trump says he's been invited and he's going to go down to the border. Now, what does that metric look like? What does that look like if former President Trump goes and tours the border and does media avails and interviews and things like that? And you have Kamala Harris, who will not go down to the border. What does that look like? Well, it looks like somebody who is deathly afraid of being seen anywhere near the border. Can't go, must not be seen near the scene of the crime. Must not. If the Biden policy does not fit, they can't acquit. I need to be acquitted of the guilt of this policy. And meanwhile, Joe Biden's over there laughing it up in Europe. He sends Kamala Harris on all these errands to Guatemala and to Mexico. And there's Joe Biden eating fancy food with the Queen, using a big old sword to cut the cake. There's Biden. There's Camilla Parker Bowles. There's Jill Biden. I don't know why. It's weird. I look at them from behind, and I just they appear to be sort of the same person, including Joe Biden. It's just like these octogenarians kind of ambling around, hanging out by the Queen. And you know the Queen doesn't want to be with any of them. The Queen's like, oh my, oh dear, oh dear, more visitors. This is terrible. These aren't the ones I wanted to visit with. I mean, it's incredible to look at what we're seeing in terms of massive rampant border insecurity. And it's really not an optional thing, because we know what's coming through the border. I'm not talking about women and children. Women and children are, they're the cover. They're the chaff that gets dropped out of the jet so that the tracking mechanisms can't take down the jet. It's the cartels. It's the terrorists coming in from the Mideast. It's the Hezbollah operatives coming up from Venezuela. Those are the people that you have to be worrying about, because that open border that we have, it's a deeper, deeper issue than the notion of somebody looking for a day laborer opportunity or looking to hook up with some COVID money. This is about American national security. And you have a president and vice president who has quite literally taken a piece of wrought iron and jammed it in the door, so the door will remain open no matter what. News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT. It is the Brent Winterbull Show. And it is great to be here with you. And I'm thrilled to welcome to the program a guest whose work I've greatly admired for a very long time. He was a special envoy for arms control under the Trump administration, but he's got a long, long track record of public service, working in the areas of security, and of course, all the big challenges that are out there internationally. Ambassador Marshall Billingsley, and he joins us now on the Newsline. Ambassador, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Brett, it's great to be with you, and thanks for having me on.
Happy to have you here. Listen, it's a busy, busy day. I'd be remiss if I didn't get your assessment sort of right out of the box. What we saw take place there in Geneva, was this stagecraft or statecraft that we watched play out between President Biden and President Putin?
No, it was complete stagecraft. Biden, can't operate without his note cards or the teleprompter. This was a sad display. All it did was give Putin a global stage to spout his propaganda, mm-hmm. which is full of false equivalencies and whataboutism.
When you look at this, it's interesting to see. We've seen a number of challenges. We've got challenges up in the Arctic, obviously. We've got challenges in the South China Sea with the Chinese. But I saw something very interesting today, and that was the decision by the Russians to run run war games basically off of Hawaii just in these last days. What message is Putin sending? Is he saying, listen, we are still the other great superpower in the world today?
Well, this is what he craves. He's a megalomaniac. He is never ending in power. He's been through five different American presidents, and this is what he wants. The reality is that Russia is a mafia run third world gas station that happens to have nuclear weapons, and we do have to treat that fact with great seriousness. But we need to put everything else in the proper context, and it's not a good thing when the president of the United States gives this kind of individual a stage, and particularly, you know, egregious was when a reporter asked him if he trusts Putin, and he clearly nodded yes.
Yeah, that was a disturbing sort of twist. And look, you certainly had pressure on Putin, issues involving people like Navalny and other opposition figures who have either been killed, disappeared, or sent off to the gulags, which is sort of his old main approach towards things. But you talk about Putin operating as essentially a mobster, or it's a mafia set up there in Russia. Are we seeing, as a result of these cyber attacks, is this essentially the shakedown operation? Is this the protection racket that we would have seen the Gambinos running in New York City back in the 1970s?
Brett, that's a great point. And it's only in these kind of kleptocratic systems where that kind of behavior not only is tolerated, but is protected. The Russians haven't lifted a finger to identify with our law enforcement the Russian cyber hacksters who attacked the Colonial Pipeline, attacked JBS, also routinely attacking the U.S. government. And part of that is not only do they give them sanctuary, but these hackers moonlight on behalf of the Russian government services with a lot of what they do.
Is there any indication, and I know I don't want you to give up any state secrets or trade craft or anything like that, is there an indication that we run the same sorts of operations, even say to harass the Russians or do anything like that, that is aggressive in response to these sorts of things? Or are we simply reactive every time we end up with a Colonial Pipeline or a JBS getting shaken down?
We're very reactive, and you know, our government is, you know, as a democracy in a Western, you know, capitalist system, we don't go attack private corporations, and we certainly don't, you know, install ransomware demanding, you know, $4 million in payment to unlock, you know, pipelines. Speaking of which, the whole pipeline topic, not only do we tolerate the Russians attacking and shutting down our pipelines, we cancel our own Keystone pipelines. And then Biden refuses to impose sanctions to stop the Russians building the Nord Stream 2 pipeline into Europe, which is all about getting the NATO nations dependent on the Russians for natural gas.
So is the president of the United States, is Joe Biden, is he doing all these things, whether it's kind of soft soaping Xi Jinping, treating the Nord Stream 2 the way he's treating it, despite, I mean, even Tony Blinken said, listen, you can't go through with this thing in March, and now suddenly we're going through with this. Is this all in pursuit of that ever desired Iranian nuclear deal? Are we placating the Russians because they're a big supplier for the Iranians and they're an important player in the Iranian universe? Is that what's going on here? Are we giving in to the Europeans because we're so desperate for that JCPOA?
Well, they're definitely desperate for the JCPOA, and I'd be happy to talk, you know, about the state of play on those negotiations in Vienna. No, I think this is more, first of all, I don't think the Biden crowd has a master strategy.
Oh, no.
I think they're making this up as they go, and they seem to be doing kind of the inverse of Theodore Roosevelt's maxim. They're speaking really loudly and making lots of threats, and they're carrying a very small stick.
It's really remarkable to watch this, because somebody much smarter than I used an analogy, and they said when Biden meets with Putin, it's going to be the exact inverse of Reagan meeting and drop off. And it's the fact that, listen, Putin knows he can outlast Biden just on age alone, but on the fact that he's going to be the president for life in that regime, essentially. And he can just wait Biden out in this regard and try to extract these considerations. One of of the interesting parts of that, though, Ambassador, is this this sort of hint that Biden laid out there during his presser right after Putin. And it appears that he seems to think that Putin is some kind of a hedge against the People's Republic of China and Xi Jinping. He says, you know, Putin wants to regard himself as one of the Bowers, one of the great leaders. Are we trying to use them as a hedge, kind of like what we did in the 1970s with the People's Republic of China?
Well, this is an issue that under the Trump administration, I, the National Security Advisor, a number of people raised repeatedly with the Russians, urging them to recognize that it's complete folly to think that the Chinese are going to ultimately treat the Russians any differently than they treat any of their other neighbors, right, with whom they have border disputes and resource disputes of almost all of them. There are less than 150 million Russians in the world, and that population size is dwindling. Yeah. There's 1.5 billion Chinese, and that number is going up. And the Chinese very clearly think that huge parts of what Russia claims today as territory were unfairly stolen from China during various treaties over the centuries. So we really do together need to work on the Russians to recognize that their alliance of temporary convenience with China is going to ultimately backfire on them, just like Stalin Ribbentrop did.
Final question for you. You've been very generous with your time, and I'd love to have you back at some point. It's been totally enjoyable. Tell me a little bit about this luncheon that you're going to be doing tomorrow in Raleigh. Where do people get more information and on what it is that you're doing as well?
Well, I appreciate that. I'm actually down here in Raleigh today, and tomorrow at noon I'll be giving a talk as part of the Bud Nance series that the Helm Center sponsors. Mm-hmm. My first boss in Washington and the man who helped give me my moral compass and taught me the skill of negotiating was Jesse Helms from North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And the Helm Center sponsors these luncheons. I'm down here to talk about the arms control issues that swirl around this very summit. In particular, I'm going to talk about this decision by the Biden crowd to sign on to the Gorbachev-Reagan statement that nuclear war is unwinnable and must never be fought. Sounds good on its face. The problem is we know that Russia has a plan to go nuclear against NATO. It's called Escalate to Win in Russian. So signing on to, you know, this kind of statement with Vladimir Putin is pure folly. Putin's no Gorbachev, and Biden is certainly no Reagan.
I'd recommend people check out jessehelmscenter.org for more information. He is Ambassador Marshall Billingsley. I would love to have you back on again at some point for an even longer and deeper conversation, and I really appreciate your service to our country, sir. Thanks for coming by today.
Thanks, Brett. Great to be with you.
All the best to you as well. That's Ambassador Marshall Billingsley, and you can get more information at jessehelmscenter.org. I'm Brett Winterbull. It is News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT, Brett Winterbull Show. Thanks again to Ambassador Billingsley for coming by and breaking down some of these big security questions. I love that end of the pool. I'm not going to lie to you. I think it's an important thing that gets oftentimes overlooked, and we don't want to overlook our callers. So what do you say we jump out? Let's talk to Peter next up. Peter, welcome to the show. Peter, how are you? Oh, wait. There you go. Peter, welcome to the show.
Good on you, Mr. Brady.
Hello, how are you?
Yes, no, I'm good, thanks. Mr. Brett, quick one. I listened to your conversation now and with the Russian ships that's in the Pacific Ocean. It just made me thought, a couple of years ago, I had the privilege to work a function at a South African banquet with a lot of your high generals of the army and the fleet. Mm-hmm. And if you go and look at South African army, 95% of them are overweight. And I asked him, listen, yeah, what happens if there's real trouble? And he said, no, we are done for. And why I'm making this comment, because as we all know, Joe Biden said that he works according to the South African model. Now, the way that the woke is infiltrating, especially the army,
yes,
in a couple of years' time, if you're going to ask a 3- or 4-star general, listen, yeah, what's going to happen? And you get all these millennials that so woke in the army, he's going to tell you, hey, we are done for.
Well, maybe. I mean, I think it depends, because what you're going to get from the military is a microcosm of the broader society, okay? But you're also, it comes down to who it is that's leading and who it is that's leading at the top of the chain of the command, meaning the commander in chief, right? Is Joe Biden going to be willing to do what he's got to do to defend the honor of the United States? That's That's the question. I don't know. He spends a lot of his time running down the United States, talking about how racist we are and how climate change is our fault. I mean, he's really good at talking down. You ever have anybody, you know, there's an old adage, right, where you say, hey, you know, I can say anything I want about my family, but if you say something bad about my family, now we're going to have a problem. Joe Biden seems to think that he's the appointed leader of the woke crowd in America, and he gets to run down America every chance he gets. And that's a dangerous position to stake out, Peter.
Yep, definitely. And I just want to make one comment.
Sure.
This has been foretold thousands and thousands of years ago. Ecclesiastes 10 verse 2 says, the heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. That's where I'm going to leave it.
All right, I appreciate you being out there, Peter. Thank you very much. Let me flesh this out, though, real quick, and then we will go back to the phones. So the largest military exercises since the Cold War are being conducted off the coast of Hawaii by Russian ships. It sent the U.S. Air Force scrambling hours before Biden met with Vladimir Putin. The exercises conducted by the Russian Navy, 300 to 500 miles west of Hawaii, include long-range bombers, surface ships, and anti-submarine aircraft. The U.S. Air Force scrambled F-22 stealth fighters from Hawaii in response to the exercises. The bombers, U.S. officials said Tuesday, did not enter the air defense identification zone and were not intercepted. The exercises come on the heels of Biden's highly anticipated summit with Vladimir Putin in Geneva. So this is the Russians. They're going to try us. They're going to test us. We know that that's the case. Every time you have a new president come into office, you have the same sort of challenges take place, whether it's the Chinese or whether it's the Russians or whether it's the Iranians. And so it's nothing really to be shocked by. It's just something to be aware of. And we have to understand the world is a dangerous place governed by the aggressive use of force by and large. And I think that's an important lesson that we've all got to take with us. Let me go to Jim. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, Brent. You know, it sounds like, it looks like, as far as the Russians go, what they're going to do is they're going to do what's called, they're going to hold us by the nose in the Pacific, and they're going to kick us in the butt when they take the Ukraine. And I wouldn't be surprised if this coincides with a movement by China to take Taiwan. This has all the earmarks of people that are getting ready to do some very bold and very provocative movement. They smell blood in the water. They smell weakness. And it's my opinion that we're going to be in for a rough couple of years here.
Okay, so what makes you think that they're going to take Taiwan? I mean, that's a pretty tall order to take Taiwan. You're talking about that would create an international crisis writ large. And,
right.
And would instantly turn, I think, China into an international pariah. There's no way. I think even more than Russia grabbing the Donbass or going after Georgia the way they did, I think Taiwan would be a unifying moment, I think, for much of the world, especially the ASEAN countries, which I know are not super powerful, but we're part of it. And, you know,
if it's done with like a long march to the institutions where they seize like the legislature, finance, military, people that are operatives inside, and it just happens in a political sense while the Russians are, holding us by the nose of the Pacific and moving into Ukraine, then it's going to be a hyper news cycle. But are we going to do something? Is somebody going to do something? Will anybody galvanize themselves to come?
Well, I think what would happen. Okay, Jim, I'll go down the path. I think to borrow a phrase from Peter Doocy over at the Fox News Channel earlier today, I think that if China decided they wanted to grab Taiwan, that Joe Biden would call his old friend Xi Jinping and say, "Come on, man, give it back. Give it back to him. Let him have it back. Don't make me send Hunter over there to straighten out the situation." I mean, I think that would be a massively huge grab. And if you're going to try to long march it, I guess you could try to make that argument. But that would be a substantial play. That'd be like Russia. That would be right on par with Russia trying to grab Alaska back.
Yes, but here's the other asset they have now. They know it's just a matter of time. They know that there are going to be health issues with our present leadership. And at that point where he's experiencing the most amount of issues that would lead us to want to transition, that's the time. I think China wants to wait. China wants to wait until after the Olympics to do anything like that, to try to start even bloviating or posturing about Taiwan.
Well,
they're looking at it and saying,
yeah.
Why would we wait?
All right, I've got a thought. I have a thought on that, Jim, so stick around, keep listening. I have a thought on this because this idea that, uh-oh, watch out, you might end up with Kamala Harris as president, I've got thoughts on that straight ahead. I'm unafraid. I'm unconcerned. 704-570-1111. It is the Brent Winterbull Show, News Talk, 1110-993 WBT. Little Van Hagar for the audience out there. Okay, I remember, and I'm old enough to remember, when George W. Bush was president of the United States and people looked at him and said, oh, he's just so dumb, he's an idiot, he doesn't know what he's doing. It's a good thing Dick Cheney's there. He's kind of like the adult in the room. And then I remember when Barack Obama got elected and people looked at Joe Biden and they said, it's a really good thing that Joe Biden's there to help him kind of steer the ways of Washington, D.C. And then, of course, you had Donald Trump. And who was his insurance policy? It was Mike Pence, right? It was the first ideological insurance policy. It basically said something like, yeah, you can impeach Donald Trump and you might even try to remove him from office. But Mike Pence is way more conservative than Donald Trump. And then you'll be sorry. So, of course, you're going to have to leave him there in office. And now what do you have? What do you have? For the first time, I think for the first time in history, you have a president who's the insurance policy for the vice president, as far as the American people are concerned, right? Because Vice President Harris has super underperformed. And I think it's fair to say that she has super underperformed. And the underperformance that we have seen in Guatemala and of course, in an inability to go to the border and a bad performance in Mexico and talking about why she wants to go to Europe, that is all really bad. That does not look well. And then last night, it's a let them eat cake moment. And she has a big dinner with all the female members of the Senate, still not going to the border, still not checking on the kids in the cages, still not doing all that sort of stuff that you'd expect from a vice president, and doing effectively no work domestically to either sell the infrastructure deal or to get the voting act through. So all of that's shot. All of that is absolutely blown up and shot. So here's what we got. We have a situation where people say this constantly. Oh, you better be careful, because if Joe Biden bows out, we're going to have President Harris. That's going to be a challenge. You know what? I'm not worried about it. The reality is, and you may disagree and you want to call and you want to rake me over the coals, go ahead and try. The reality is there's a lot of inertia in the federal government. All right. If you set aside the ideological sputterings of the president and you look at kind of the way the government functions, it kind of functions on its own of inertia. Joe Biden has been a tremendous ideologue for the left. I mean, he's been like the most liberal president since I don't even know who. Like, he is like the self-realization of what Mario Cuomo would have been. I mean, he's a class warrior. He takes every opportunity he can to run America down, to say we're back, but never to say that we're going to do great things. He's just wired in a strange way. It's almost like he's decided he wants his term to be an atonement term or something. And so people go, well, watch out, because he's moderate. And if Kamala Harris gets in there as president, then we're going to, no, you know what we're going to have at that point? You're going to have opposition. You're going to have opposition. You want to come and grab the guns? If you think that the recipe for success in the United States is a San Francisco liberal or an Oakland liberal, you are wildly mistaken. You're wildly mistaken. The country looks a lot more like Ron DeSantis, Candace Owens, or Candace Owens, Ron DeSantis, or Kristi Noem and somebody else than it does San Francisco. San Francisco and New York are toxic assets. And anybody that wants to run for the highest office or assume the highest office from either those two hellholes, and I know Trump came from New York, but Trump came out of, he wasn't from politics. You know, you're not going to go and have Nadler be your president. You're not going to have Schumer be your president. You're not going to have AOC be your president. I mean, just, it's not going to happen. They're too radical. You're not going to have de Blasio as your president. San Francisco, Northern California, New York, you're not going to take anybody out of those two bullpens to be your closer or to be your ace, really, because you're talking about taking someone who's a closer and making them an ace. That's really hard. So whenever people go, well, you know, you got to be careful because Joe Biden's got to stay there because Kamala Harris can be impeached just like anybody else can be thwarted just like anybody else can. And I would submit to you that if the Democrats really want to see what a wipeout looks like, have Joe Biden take a long walk off the stage right now and bring in Vice President Harris as the president, and let's look at what those 2022 elections look like. Because I think right now, with Biden at the top of the ticket, intact right now as is in 500 days, I think it's a devastating wipeout. I think if Harris is at the top of the ticket with a vice president, who'd she pick as a vice president? She'd pick like Elizabeth Warren, right? That would be a cataclysmic. It would be a generational wipeout for the Democratic Party, because you would literally have a buffet of overregulation, grievance, gun grabbing, and insane taxes. Remember, a couple days ago, I made fun of Tom Suozzi. Tom Suozzi wants a one-time patriotic wealth tax. That's called Tuesday for Elizabeth Warren. And I think you would see something incredibly radical take shape. And I think you would have Wall Streeters jumping out the windows of their offices, and not because the market crashed. They would just do it in anticipation of what was likely coming in terms of hyper-regulation. People do not want to go down that road. I am confident of that. So whenever I hear people, because I have it said to me and I have it texted to me and I have it Facebook messaged to me, oh, be careful, you may end up with a Kamala Harris as president. If I bring it, I fear nobody when it comes to the ideological battles out there. Now, again, my assessment is strictly based on politics and is strictly based on what I think the politics would be. You may disagree, 704-570-1110, but running on a straight defund the cops, less safe cities, CRT, climate change, Green New Deal, all that sort of stuff. Boy, oh boy, are you asking for trouble out there once you get into those congressionals and those Senate races and those down ballot races. It's a recipe for a wipeout. It's something I think that Joe Biden is well aware of, and I think that's why he's going for all the chips on the table at the same time, even though he's got a pair of twos. Because I think he understands he really does only have a half a term to have any kind of an impact. And we are rapidly approaching July and then August and then the fall and then the calendar turns to 2022. I said this to the North Carolina 11 Republican group that Michelle Woodhouse put together earlier this week. What it's going to come down to is convincing people, convincing one person at a time to see the error of socialism and to embrace the virtues of a more free market approach. But it's about being joyous warriors and not being fearful. It's about being confident and understanding your convictions. Take your phone call straight ahead. Another great hour right in front of us. 704-570-1110. It is the Brett Winterbull Show, News Talk 1110 at 99.3 WBT. Great to be here with you. And there's a guy who is a reporter for CNN, and his name is Jeff Zeleny. Jeff Zeleny, you've probably seen him before. He's complaining about Biden, and this guy's an absolute pinko commie leftist. This guy, Jeff Zeleny, came out and said that he's never seen a president so protected by aides not wanting him to answer questions from the press. After Joe Biden snapped at a reporter, I've never seen a president covering the last four of them who is so protected by his aides in terms of often not wanting him to answer some questions. He is the chief national affairs correspondent for the Chicken Noodle News Network, CNN. And he says he's bothered by this. Caitlin Collins got yelled at. Did you see this? Caitlin Collins got yelled at when she said, why are you confident that Putin's going to change his behavior? And Biden snaps at her and goes, I'm not confident. I'm not confident I'm going to change his behavior. What the hell? Why do you do that all the time? When did I say I was confident? I said, let's get it straight. And then Peter Doocy went at him.
and said, what are you going to ask your old friend Xi Jinping to open up the Wuhan Center? Biden was fit to be tied. He's not used to these tough questions. He's used to, you know, you ever come walking into a room, like TJ, I bet this happened to you. You ever come walking into a room and then suddenly there's a shower of cotton balls being thrown at you?
Oh, this happens daily.
And it's very hard to take those cotton balls and heave them back in a violent and distressing manner because that's not how cotton balls roll. But do they roll? That's the question. But the reality is he gets pelted with cotton balls every day. Nobody asks him any tough questions. I have the piece of sound. Let me get that piece of sound. TJ, we need this piece of sound. I need a cut number. Which one was it? Wait a minute. This will not count against me, I promise. It will be... It's the one where they're saying, I got tough questions for... Oh, cut 27. This is Joe Biden about to take the first question today in Geneva. Go.
I'll take your questions, and as usual, folks, they gave me a list of the people I'm going to call on. So, Jonathan, okay, Associated Press.
So stop. He asks about Russian collusion and the same old talking point. But who the heck has the power over the president of the United States to tell him what questions he could take? Be honest for a quick second. Do you think, and I'm going to be ecumenical, I'm going to be nonpartisan, do you think that you could tell Donald Trump who he could take a question from or not? No. Barack Obama? No. Bill Clinton? No. George W. Bush? Heck no. George H.W. Bush? No. Reagan? No. Carter? No. I mean, how far back do we have? You think you're going to tell Richard Nixon or LBJ that he can't take a question from somebody? LBJ was taking questions from people while he was peeing, like in real time with the door open. I mean, you don't tell the president, okay, you can talk to these six people. They've been pre-approved right here. Just talk to them. That's horrible. That's an admission. That's an admission of having lost your political fastball. And you can say anything you want about Putin. And I don't think Putin's a good guy. He's not our friend. He is, as Ambassador Billingsley said, you know, he's a gangster. He is all those things. But if you're the president of the United States and you're out there at an international event and you've got to answer questions, you've got to answer questions. Period. Full stop. I don't like this. Well, we're going to manage whether or not he gets to ask. That one is a mean person. Because what's going to happen if you lock these people out from the questions, if you keep going to the same old Associated Press, Jennifer Jacobs, Reuters, what have you. The other reporters are going to start to get really prickly about this, and they are going to jump in. Caitlin Collins is going to jump in and do something that she's literally never done before, which is hold a Democrat to account. And Peter Ducey is going to jump in there and ask those questions. So the point of this entire endeavor is we are looking at a whole new world. When Jeff Zeleny, who's like one of the big kahunas at CNN, says, I've never seen a president so protected from questions, that is terrible. Like, that's embarrassing. It's really the press interaction equivalent of the car. Remember the car rallies he did where he would stand on a stage and the people would honk their horns at him? It was just really terrible. It's not anything that you would ever want to see. The mayor of Chicago is someone called Lori Lightfoot. She is now begging for federal assistance after a second mass shooting in 4 days. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot made an impassioned plea for state and federal assistance following the city's second mass shooting in less than a week. ABC News reporting that she's begging the Biden administration and the Illinois governor's office for help in quelling the city's out-of-control gun violence. She focused her request for solutions to the, quote, illegal gun problem, suggesting that Chicago, which has some of the nation's strictest gun laws, is suffering because of more lenient gun laws elsewhere and a lack of uniform federal response to the illicit gun trade. Okay, so if you believe there are people carrying firearms in an unapproved, illegal way, how do you get those guns out of the hands of criminals? Anybody have any ideas? How would you do it? If you were the police chief of a city and you had an epidemic of gun violence, What would you do? How would you stop the epidemic of gun violence? You don't have any jurisdiction as a police chief or as a mayor to go threaten Indiana, which is her default position. Just, it's always Indiana. It's always Indiana. It's always Indiana. How do you do it? What you do is you enforce laws on the streets. What you do is you have a mayor say, we're no longer doing defund the police. That was just a talking point and it was stupid and it didn't work. And people have died as a result of that really bad policy. I mean, I'd be willing to see. We could probably run the numbers. We could probably run the numbers. In fact, I'm going to do it in real time, real quick. I'm going to tell you right now how many people have been shot and killed in Chicago. Because I happen to be able to go to the website called Hey Jack ASS, and there are numbers there. So, year to date, 293 shot and killed in Chicago. Shot and wounded, 1,404. Total people shot in Chicago, year to date, 1,700 people. Homicides, 310. That is an epidemic of violence. That is an epidemic of violence. In fact, they even break it down by number. They even break it down by number. 143 got shot in the head. 255 got shot in the arms. 58, unknown other parts of the body. 365 shot in the torso. 579 shot in the lower body, including the groonies. I mean, so the thing is, what are you going to do? You got to enforce the laws. You have to enforce the laws. The laws are, if you are carrying an illegal firearm, and by an illegal firearm, we're talking felon in possession, you got to enforce those laws. Otherwise, more people are going to die. That's what's got to be told. I know it's a hard truth, but it's a reality. And it's a reality that has to be understood quickly. News Talk 1110-993 WBT. You know what time it is. It's the time we cross the streams. And I am Brett Witterbull. It is great to be here with you. Welcoming to the program. Man, I got to ask him a question right out of the box. Don't let him hear what I'm saying. Bo Thompson joins us. Bo, are you pro-croc or anti-croc when it comes to footwear?
Oh, 100% anti-croc.
Oh, me too. Oh, thank goodness. I was on a plane last
week. Honestly, I've never worn a croc, so maybe I don't know what I'm missing, but based on what I've seen without putting them on, I'm not interested.
I was on a plane last weekend coming back, and a guy had crocs on his feet and then took them off and put them in the aisle. Like, he was on the aisle seat, and he placed them next to his seat in the aisle, like he was the opening to a home. It was really disturbing to see it. And these were like Day-Glow orange Crocs. And he had socks, which I don't understand.
It's very interesting that you bring this up, because I was just having a conversation with my wife earlier today, and I made the comment. Now, I'm a flip-flop wearer.
I'll go flip-flops.
Yeah, but I'll tell you this. One of the things the last several years that I've noticed is that I think, you know, there's a little too much walking barefooted on concrete and around the pool and the flip-flop thing, too, because I have these really thin ones that I probably need to replace, but I like them, so I keep them around. But my feet are so beat up by the time you get to August and September, I've been making a point to not wear flip-flops, but not go barefooted as much, trying to, like, salvage, you know, my feet. But I don't know, man. I like flip-flops, but the Crocs to me, I don't know. It's like they're flip-flops, but they're enclosed, and it's just
it's
weird.
Gross.
I don't know.
It's wrong. By the way, if your flip-flops blow out, you can always put a bread tie underneath the flip-flop to maintain usage, by the way.
Well, here's another aside. I remember one time I was working in TV, and we did a story about, you know, and you see those germaphobe stories all the time.
Yeah.
You see them all the time before COVID. Now it's everybody's thinking about hygiene. But I used to see those stories all the time. You know, how dirty is that handle on the bathroom door at the public restroom? Or how, you know, what are the places where there are all kinds? Your phone, for example. You know,
how
germy is your phone? We did a story one time about how germy are your flip-flops. And then you start thinking about your flip-flops and your feet, and it was enough to make you put off flip-flops forever. But I haven't gotten to that point yet. But for some reason, the Crocs thing, I don't even know why, Brett. I just don't like them. And
I don't know. They're in the same category. They're the same category as Birkenstocks. And I'm sorry to take up all this important.
Absolutely. You just nailed it.
I feel like if you wear them, it's like you've lost. Like the war did not go the way, and we're now being hostage held. We have to wear orange Crocs and Birkenstocks. No.
Spot on.
Yeah. I'd rather run barefoot through the woods. Okay, here's let's dive into this real quick here. There's a story. So Chris Paul is having like a career year in the NBA playoffs, right? I mean, he's lighting it up. He's like a man, you know, reborn with the Phoenix Suns. And now we find out he may not be able to play because of the COVID protocols. What's going on with this?
Well, and again, this is an interesting story because now we're in the vaccine era. So, you know, there and this is also of note today because Sam Darnold was asked again about getting vaccinated at Panthers practice, and he essentially said that he's going to keep his decision about getting a vaccine to himself. And the leagues are now coming out with protocols about what players who have not been vaccinated have to do, and the contract tracing that we've been used to, and the quarantines, a lot of that stays in effect if you choose not to get vaccinated. I don't know the full background on Chris Paul and what his personal decisions have been, but the last I saw on this, he very well could be kept out of the Western Conference Finals, in which they're on the doorstep of. They're the one team, the Phoenix Suns, that have finished their series and are waiting around. The good thing for Chris Paul is he has some time to wait around while this other series finishes, but this very well could keep him out of the next round and potentially the final round.
It's a huge deal. I mean, this is a guy, he had a tremendous career at Wake Forest, right? I mean, and is now playing with the Phoenix Suns after bouncing around a number of different teams. And I just I'd hate to see him miss this opportunity.
Absolutely. And yes, he played for Wake Forest. He also, he never played for the Charlotte Hornets, but played for the New Orleans Hornets right after the Charlotte team left and went to New Orleans. He became a star there early on with the Hornets, and then he went to the L.A. Clippers. And
yeah,
was part of
that
Washington,
was engineered.
And now he's bounced around.
Yeah.
But he's one of those guys that is having the season that we always thought he'd have, but he never quite got the shot to play on a team that went this far just because of circumstances. So to get this far now and maybe not be able to continue, it's a tough story. But not to mention, I mean, Kawhi Leonard went down today.
Yep.
There's stories all over the NBA about changing in these series. We saw Kevin Durant last night score 49 points.
Unbelievable.
But he's missing his other two partners, Kawhi Leonard and James Harden. James Harden was hobbled last night. So all of a sudden, you know, everything, and then I don't know if you saw this, but LeBron James just put out a very, very lengthy post this afternoon on social media, essentially saying that these injuries are happening because players had to get back to it too quickly after the pandemic.
Come on. He had minutes management all year. That wasn't his excuse. His excuse wasn't that he was hurt. His excuse was that he came up short. A good friend of mine that used to play in the NBA, that used to play in the NFL, had a saying for this. He's like, everybody's hurt by this time of the year. Okay, everybody is injured and hurt. Just you got to gut through it. You got to get it done, and that's what's got to happen. All right, quickly, who do we got coming up tomorrow on the award-winning Bo Thompson Morning Show?
You may have heard of him. Pat McCrory is coming back tomorrow for a couple of hours. I talked to him earlier about 3 or 4 hours ago, and he's ready, and he's got lots to talk about. I mean, this is actually a perfect time for him to be making a stop. He's on the campaign trail, of course, and said that he's just, since he left the show, he's just been out raising money and raising money and raising money. And
it's awesome.
But he's going to talk about a lot of things that have been in the headlines, including himself. So
that's great. I'm looking forward to that. Hey, by the way, you know that tour that that the president's doing with Bill O'Reilly around the couple different venues, you know, the tour he's doing? Do you know what the number one, do you know what the top ticket cost on that is? You ready for this?
I'm ready.
$7,500.
To be on the front row?
Yep.
Wow.
That's too
much. I guarantee you there are people out there who will pay it.
Of course. Big country, maybe, but that for $7,500? I don't know. All right.
as Pat McCrory would say, that's adult money.
That's adult money. Bo Thompson, good stuff, man. Appreciate you being there, and have a great rest of your night. News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT. A man can hope, a man can pray, a man can breathe. There's a petition out there. This is going to really get you guys going.
So sit down and listen to this. There is a petition to ban Jeff Bezos from returning to Earth when he goes up to outer space in a couple of months. A petition to ban Amazon founder Jeff Bezos from returning to Earth is gaining traction online. There are more than 10,000 people who signed the change.org petition as of Wednesday. Thousands of people are calling for Jeff Bezos to be denied re-entry to Earth after the space launch. He announced he'd be part of his company's first human space flight set to launch on July 20th. Quote, I want to go on this flight because it's a thing I wanted to do all my life. It's adventure and it's a big deal for me. While a lot of people don't want the Amazon founder to come back from space, the change.org petition's wording is a little bit odd. Here's you're going to like this, TJ. Jeff Bezos, this is the wording. Jeff Bezos is actually Lex Luthor, disguised as the supposed owner of a super successful online retail store. However, he's actually an evil overlord hell-bent on global domination. We've known this for years. Jeff has worked with the Epsteins and the Knights Templar, as well as the Freemasons, to gain control over the whole world. He's also in bed with the flat earth deniers. It's the only way they'll allow him to leave the atmosphere. Meanwhile, our government stands by and lets it happen. Now, people are really mad at Jeff Bezos because he routinely doesn't pay huge amounts of taxes. That's according to ProPublica. I get it. However, he could still run Amazon from space, so it doesn't matter whether he comes back or not. So it is pretty hilarious that people do not want him to come back. But yeah, there you have it. Jeff Bezos, they're petitioning 10,000 subscriptions or subscribers or signatories that do not want to have Jeff Bezos come back from planet Earth. Are you as surprised as I am that we haven't seen somebody who's like a big-time politician go up in outer space yet? Like, wouldn't you think in all seriousness that there's a congressperson or a senator? I know we've had John Glenn go back up to space. But I'm talking about like one of these average run-of-the-mill type Congress critters, like one of those people that nobody can stand to be around, like an Eric Swalwell type. I'm surprised that they haven't angled to get onto one of these rides to go up in outer space. And I mention Eric Swalwell for an important reason. And this to me is a remarkable tale. So he is suing Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama for the January 6th riot. Now, we talked about this in hour number one. And if you missed hour number one, you got to go back and get the podcast for hour number one. Hour number one, we had the story at a revolver.news that is contending that there are about 18 or 19 at least unindicted co-conspirators who may very well be federal agents who helped to instigate the January 6th riot, the January 6th insurrection, and that these people were in elevated positions inside organizations like the Proud Boys or the Three Percenters or the Oath Keepers or Up With People or whatever it is. And they were, you know, they were involved. I know Up With People wasn't part of the insurrection. I was just being ironically funny from the 70s. But you've got these people who may have been ginned up and hyped up to go and commit this sort of riotous behavior at the January 6th insurrection. So we know that that's an element there, but it's not good enough for Eric Swalwell. Eric Fang Fang Swalwell is come out and has said he believes Mo Brooks, because Mo Brooks gave a speech at the Trump rally before the riot at the Capitol. He says Mo Brooks incited people to riot. Remember, they were trying to hang this on Josh Hawley, and they were trying to hang this on Mo Brooks and a couple of other people. Rudy Giuliani was also somebody that they were saying, oh, these guys, people are responsible for all the riots that took place. Well, here's the crazy thing. Eric Swalwell is suing Mo Brooks in federal court for the riot. And this is really a case. This is the sort of nonsense that is being wasted. So he has to serve Mo Brooks. You can look all this up if you don't believe me. He has to serve Mo Brooks. Yes, I know Mo Brooks, Mo Problems. Mo Brooks has to get served papers for the lawsuit. And because of the security at the Capitol in the wake of January 6th, Mo Brooks
it's not known when he comes or goes to the Capitol. So little Eric Swalwell stands around trying to serve him with the papers, and Mo Brooks isn't there. They knock on the door. They're all like, Mo, are you in there? No, nobody's here. Nobody's here right now. I'm just the intern. I'm watching the office. You know, and so they can't get a straight answer. So what does Eric Swalwell do? He goes and he hires like a second story man, as they would say back in the old days, somebody who could break into an apartment. So he goes and he hires a guy, one of his staffers, and he says, you got to fly out to Alabama and you got to go serve these papers on the Mo Brooks family, him and his wife, so I can sue him in federal court. So the guy goes out to Mo Brooks's house. Somehow the allegation, according from Mo Brooks, is he gains entry into Mo Brooks's house. This is a congressman. Gains entry into his house and like sneaks up on the wife and serves papers on her. Well, Mo Brooks is freaking out. He's like, who did you, what goon squad did you send over to my house to serve me with papers and scare my wife half to death? This is Alabama. The guy's actually lucky he's not leaving with more lead in his pants, by the way. But here's the thing. Mo Brooks has now gone to the cops in Alabama. And he swore out a complaint, and he wants Eric Swalwell and the guy arrested for B&E into his house for serving the wife. So this thing's not going away anytime soon. Look, Swalwell is a teeny tiny cretin of a man, and he's desperate for some notoriety. And that is what is going on here. But I can't wait. I can't wait. And I hope that somehow, some way, they're able to hire somebody to go take Eric Swalwell and his cohort into custody and take him back in front of a good old-fashioned Alabama judge that's going to sit there and be like, I'm sorry, you committed a B&E. You're also a flight risk. You're going to be sitting here in this jail until trial in 2023. This is what I want to see. Because if you're dumb enough to sue a fellow congressperson and blame them for the riot, you kind of got what's coming your way. News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT.
Better bumper music.
Oh, come on. Are you kidding me? You know what this is, Mark?
Well, it's better than what you normally play to introduce
what?
Me.
This is TJ. Forgot about Dre, right? It's Dr. J. Next episode. How about that, man? We got a little Dre for you.
Yeah, all right. I'm
a little
good.
Dre for Mark. So, like, let's assume we were looking at the big stories on Charlotte at 6.
Yes.
Which happens to be, this is the saddest time of the entire show to me because I got to hand it over. What are we looking at in terms of the big story?
At 6:05, breaking news from CMS. We're going to tell you about a controversial book that principals and assistant principals have been required to read about fighting racism. The writer has some interesting stuff to say. For instance, he says we're taught to look down on blacks and elevate whites. Some principals are not happy they're having to read this book.
All right, we'll be watching closely on that one.
Yeah, it's been about a year now since gunmen opened fire at that block party in Charlotte on the west side. Cops today said, no, we don't have very many leads. 5 people were killed. It was a big
deal. That's, they said there were hundreds of rounds shot, and there were lots of witnesses outside.
Yep.
And what's the reward is, what, $17,000?
Yep, exactly. I mean, it's a classic case of people who just don't want to talk to the cops.
Gosh! All right.
Yeah. Putin-Biden summit, not a lot accomplished. We'll talk about that. But at 6:35, success at 6. Today we'll tell you about a man who is well into his 80s. He still draws an excited crowd with his boiled peanuts. Listen, these people get excited.
You know, don't nuts always call a woman? They're just so good.
Wow! That's awesome.
It's a great story.
I'm in on the boiled peanuts 100% of the time.
All
so
right.
That's awesome. All right, Mark Garrison.
Yes, sir.
You got a great show, man. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you, sir.
All right, man. That's Mark Garrison, Charlotte at 6, coming up appropriately just after 6. I think it's going to be a fascinating program. I'm a huge fan of boiled peanuts, by the way. I like them spicy too. Spicy like Joe Biden spicy. You know, I'm thinking about this showdown that wasn't there in Geneva. And when you think about what it was that this was being hyped as, a big showdown between Joe Biden and Vlad Putin, the end of this whole conversation, Vladimir Putin, I thought he comported himself really well. And here's the fundamental problem for Joe Biden. He gets back to the United States. He's not coming back to Geneva and Buckingham Palace and all the Europeans with their elite, effete sort of attitudes towards things. He's coming back to actual real problems. He's coming back to real serious issues. Here, let me give you an example. This is cut number 26. This is Texas Governor Greg Abbott talking about his desire and his efforts to enforce the border with Mexico. Go.
Making arrests. We've turned over more than 35,000 people that we apprehended illegally in the state of Texas to federal officials. We're tired of the turnover game and the catch and release game. We want to arrest people and put them in jail for a long time so that they will know they're no longer going to be getting the Biden red carpet treatment. They're going to be going to jail if they come into Texas. But, Sean, we both know that a fence is only a temporary solution. The real solution that President Trump began to put in place, that Texas is going to continue. And that is later on this week, I will be announcing what the Texas plan is for building a border wall. We will continue that process of building the border wall in addition to these other strategies that we will use to make sure that anybody coming here will understand Texas is the wrong state to come into.
Now, this is a hugely important story because when Donald Trump was president, you had all of these horrible governors, Jay Inslee in Washington, Kate Brown in Oregon, goofy Gavin Newsom in the state of California, and they all declared themselves sanctuary states. Gavin Newsom said, if you can come here, it doesn't matter where you're from around the world, we're going to give you free health care, absolute free health care. And he's gone back to delivering on that now. He says, basically, if you got toenail fungus in Tajikistan, come on out to California. We're going to hook you up with a remedy. If you got if you've got some kind of a problem with your plantar fasciitis, Then come on in here from Finland. We'll take care of you. If you're sitting back and you got double vision in the Dominican Republic, come on into California. We'll give you the hookup. Heck, it doesn't even matter. If you need Narcan and you're in North Korea, come on in. We'll take care of you. It doesn't matter. Just get here. We need you. Why, oh, why is it a bad thing for Governor Abbott to take a strong stance on the border, to act as the new resistance? Except this isn't really resistance. Newsom and Kate Brown and Pritzker in Illinois and Inslee and in the state of Washington and Whitmer and Evers and Cuomo and Cooper and the whole rotting lot of the Democratic governors. Why is it different when Abbott is looking to build a wall at the border? Because Abbott is using federalism. He's using the rights of the states to enforce the law that are guaranteed in the Constitution. Everybody else involved is invoking lawlessness. Lawlessness. So that's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. He is looking to help to keep America safe, and he's looking at keeping the residents of Texas safe. Joe Biden is done with his excellent adventure, hanging out with Vlad and hanging out with Macron and hanging out with Merkel. The reality is, at the end of the day, he's got to get back to governing and he's got to deliver on the promises. Now that Biden's had his excellent adventure and his big meeting with Putin, he's got to actually get back to work. And he's got to get back to work on that progressive agenda that AOC and Bernie Sanders are demanding he deliver on. The one person I would not want to be starting tomorrow is Chuck Schumer, because the boss is back in town and Schumer's phone is going to be blowing up from crazy kooky progressives saying, are we socialist yet? Are we socialist yet? Are we socialist yet? What's the delay, Chuck? What's the delay? It's going to do it for me. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll do it again tomorrow starting at 3. News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT.